evening, everybody. Welcome to the Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name's Judy. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Judy.
For those who wish to join us, let's open the meeting with a serenity prayer. God,
grant me serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen.
Amen. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome on the first floor of this house. Please don't go upstairs. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask that those present please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep the distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everybody to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA's simple actions. I'll now read the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We're self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open big book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. This evening, we're discussing the second part of step one, and I'm going to turn the meeting over to David.
Good evening, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name's David.
Hey.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
I'd like to welcome everybody to the Simple Actions Group. The vision for this meeting, it's a little bit different format. You run into step studies that use the 12 and 12, or you go to a big book study that goes through whatever number of pages of the big book. We're simply trying to have an ongoing step study using the paragraphs out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous to talk about the steps. And it's our intention to share experience, strength, and hope working with the book, working with sponsors on the steps. And it's not our intention to teach. There are plenty of people in the room who know much more about this big book than we do. But we're just here to share experience, strength, and hope as it was shared with us in the hope that it'll be useful and helpful to other people. So we're going to kick off tonight. We're talking about step one, second half. Last week we talked about the first part of step one. We found that step one kind of neatly falls into two sort of categories. The allergy, which we discussed at length last week, that abnormal reaction when I take any alcohol into my system whatsoever. The phenomenon of craving develops, and no matter how much I get, I'm still thirsty. And this seems to be unique to the alcoholic. And so tonight, the second piece of that is the obsession of the mind. I've got I heard it shared the other day. I've got a mind that doesn't work and a body that won't die. So that seems to be one of the problems. We're going to kick off tonight on page 5. We're in Bill's story, and it's about 3/4 of the way down the stage. It starts with, "I woke up." I'm just going to read, and then we'll talk a little bit. So, "I woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw I could not take so much as one drink. I was through forever. Before then, I had written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed that this time I meant business, and so I did. Shortly afterward, I came home drunk. There had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. Someone had pushed a drink my way, and I had taken it. Was I crazy? I began to wonder, for such an appalling lack of perspective seemed to be near just that. Renewing my resolve, I tried again. Some time passed, and confidence began to be replaced by cocksureness. I could laugh at the gin mills. Now I had what it takes. One day I walked into a cafe to telephone. In no time I was beating on the bar, asking myself how it happened. As the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself I would manage better next time, but I might as well get good and drunk then, and I did. I started drinking when I was about 13 years old, in earnest. By the time I was in early teens, I was well on my way. I got sober when I was 28 years old, so I had a relatively short 15-year career drinking. But these particular paragraphs kind of describe the last 6 years of my drinking. It was a good idea for me to stop drinking very early in that career. You know, it was a good idea in high school. It was a good idea by the time I was 19. I'd been to the funerals of four of my friends. I saw that I wasn't going to graduate from high school. So almost on a bet, a doctor dared me to stop drinking for 30 days. And so I did. And I found during that time that I was able to make it to class. I was able to do my homework. I was able to pay attention. I was able to get some things done. So I had a sufficient reason that was strong enough. I put the plug in the jug. I went back to school. I finished. I ended up, you know, having a chance at college. I would later drink that away as well. So there were lots of good ideas for me to stop drinking. I was 22 years old when I showed up here by accident. I checked into a 72-hour detox facility run by the city of Norfolk. And based on my ability to pay, they ran it through a little sliding scale, and it was going to cost me like $3 a day. And I could sign a paper for that. So that got me into a detox where I met you lovely people. And I was not interested in what you were offering. This idea of being powerless over alcohol was absolutely abhorrent to me. The 22-year-old version of me was not powerless over anything. I was really convinced. I loved the renewing my resolve. I resolved to stop drinking. And I resolved to stop drinking. I don't know about anybody else, but I resolved to stop drinking hundreds of times. I was more of a binge drinker. I used to party as hard as I could for as long as I could, as long as the money and time were there, and then I would suck it up and try to make it onto that job and show up and keep my promises as best I could, and just killing time to the weekends, you know. And of course, eventually the weekend started on Thursday and finished up around Wednesday morning. But it didn't start that way. If it started that way, I might have had a better clue, you know. But so this idea of being powerless, I was convinced that there was something that I could do to solve the problem. So I just kept quitting. And all of those things, like laughing at the gin mills, now I had what it takes. I would just stop. And I would do things like, I would stop and then I'd be 30 days, but I would go back doing what I used to do. I'd go back to the bar to let everybody know how well I was doing. You know, so all the time I'm restless, irritable, discontent. I'm basically miserable. I don't know what's wrong with me, but I will not seek any help for this. I'm gonna handle this. David's got it. I don't need any help. Thank you very much. So that was 6 years of living that way. In and out, in and out, and in and out. So I don't know how many times, how many hobbies, how many gym memberships, how many diets, how many new girls, how many cities, how many jobs, how many ways I tried to manage and control to stay away from the drink. My self-will. I'm going to handle this. And just grind my way through another day not drinking. And that's what not drinking's like. Not drinking. You walk up to me during one of these dry periods and ask me how I'm doing, I'm going to tell you, I'm not drinking. And my boss is a jerk, and my girlfriend is a jerk, and there's not enough money, and there's not enough time, and, blah, 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 and the political situation, and my God, did you see what, you know, I mean, I'm just miserable in my own skin. In short, I'm an alcoholic who doesn't have a drink in me. I need a drink, and I got no solution, I got no drink. So I would once again, I would go through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful, firm resolution not to drink again, and some period of time passes. There was almost a year. I did a year one time like that, from age 22 to 23 after I met you guys. No drink, no Alcoholics Anonymous. But the time and place always comes where I take that one again, and then the allergy takes over, back in the game, on and off. 6 years like that.
Thank you. Yeah, so I woke up. I woke up a lot and wondered what was going on. I was baffled. I was really baffled. This disease is a disease of deception, and I didn't understand until after I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that what I saw is power, because I thought drinking gave me power, was actually powerlessness. And that's how cunning, baffling, and powerful alcohol is. It seduced me into believing that what I thought was correct, which is a frightening thing. I mean, that kind of takes my breath, because it told me so many things were right that were wrong. And I ended up in places with people that I should never have been with, and woke up in places I wish I couldn't remember that I woke up in. And I would just get up and be just absolutely horrified for, you know, maybe 8 hours, sometimes 24. And then I would say to myself, because I had this thing in my gut that told me I needed to have another drink. I absolutely had to drink. So I had to come up with, after going through that horrifying situation, whatever it happened to be, I had to come up with a palatable reason to do that again. I had to convince myself. It talks a lot about self-deception in our literature, and I had to convince myself that it was okay to do that again. And it's absolutely powerful. Just about took my life from me. So, the time when I really woke up, when I started coming here, I started my journey getting here, which didn't happen overnight. It happened. It was pretty slow, really. I woke up one day standing over my daughter's crib in my clothes. I had been out in the club the night before in. And she was screaming, crying, and I stood there, and I had come home that night. It was the summer, and I came home that night and turned on the air conditioning, and because I was hot, because I had been dancing, and everything's about me, so I turned the air down to like 60, and this poor child is, you know, crying and cold, and I can't remember how old she was. She was just a baby. And I went in and stood over a crib, and I thought, oh my God, it's gonna happen. I can't stop this. I don't have any control over this at all. I don't know what's gonna happen the next time. And that scared me, but it didn't prompt me to do anything particularly different. You know, once I got past that, a little bit of time passed over that, you know, then I could give myself a palatable reason why it was okay again. And but that kind of stuck in my mind a little bit, just enough. You know, it was God's way of talking to me. I know today that as an active drinker, I had absolutely no conscience and no will to do anything about my drinking. I had no conscience or consideration of the well-being of others, because I had no conscience, and I had drowned it in alcohol. Alcohol allowed me to do things outside of what normal people can refrain from doing because they have something in their mind that tells them that's the wrong thing to do. I had some understanding of what right and wrong was, but I didn't have a conscience about it as a drinker. So I lost the ability, and that's really what powerlessness to me is. I lost the ability to have a conscience and consider you in anything that I did. And when I stood over that baby's crib that day, I knew that I could not care about her. And that is a horrible place to stand, stone cold sober after being drunk that night. I knew I don't care about this child who is dependent on me. And I have to tell you that nothing else could have made that kind of impact on me, because I had plenty of reasons before that night to have to need to stop drinking, lots of them. But it took that. So I stood there, and that just stuck in my head. And it's kind of like we say when we go to AA, when you get a head full of AA, you know, drinking isn't so much fun anymore. And once I had that realization, even though it was way back in the back of my mind, I had a really hard time having too much fun drinking. But I couldn't stop the drinking, because I did have a mental obsession with myself and with alcohol and an inability to stop my insides from churning unless I took another drink. So that's a pretty damn horrible place to be. And outside of divine intervention, there's no way out of that. So I went on my way, and you know, I couldn't help caring about this baby. This totally freaks me out, you know. No connection to that. No human connection to that, to another human being. So I kept drinking until the next thing that happened. So I think it was almost a year before after that happened that I came to AA. But that was my first wake up, where I was really awake for a minute, truly awake. Thanks.
Next. Okay, we're on to page 7, middle of the page. It relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it remains strong in other respects. My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hope. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. I went to town regularly, even made a little money. Surely this was the answer, self-knowledge. But it was not, for the frightful day came when I drank once more. The curve of my declining moral and bodily health fell off like a ski jump. After a time, I returned to the hospital. This was the finish, the curtain, it seemed to me. My weary and despairing wife was informed they would all end with heart failure during delirium tremens, or I would develop a wet brain, perhaps within a year. Soon she would have to give me over to the undertaker or the asylum. Yeah, so in my 6 years of trying to stop, you know, I mean, at this point, I'm fully acquainted with the fact that this is a problem, that the alcoholic life is the only normal one. It's what I do. I'm sort of deluded that I'm destined to do this, that I have to do this. I come from a long line of alcoholic people. These are my people. This is what I do. These are who my friends are. But it's a problem. You know, I mean, it's destructive. It's getting in the way of all kinds of things, and the things that I'm capable of doing are becoming increasingly abhorrent to me. I come into Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, when I say I come into Alcoholics Anonymous during those 6 years, I don't mean I came into AA, put the plug in the jug, got a home group, got a sponsor, worked steps, made a commitment to sobriety one day at a time. What I mean by that is I would come in the back door, and I would sit near the exit, and I would just listen, and I would judge you all, and I would confirm to myself that you were all a bunch of losers and I didn't need to be here. And then as soon as the Lord's Prayer happened or whatever weird thing was going to happen next, phew, I was out the door. You know, and I was, and this paragraph talks about this self-knowledge being the answer. I've used two things now, and what I remember hoping was I would come here and I would maybe learn something. I'd maybe learn something that would give me the power to manage my life and to get on with this thing. Or maybe I could still drink and get away with it. Maybe I could still have my cake and eat it too. Maybe, you know, maybe I would learn whatever it was. I'm starting to show up at psychiatrists now. And my hope in that office was that some hidden spring of my mind would be revealed to me. And then once I had that information, then I wouldn't do these abhorrent things, you know. I mean, I'm coming to just absolutely disgusted and appalled with the things that I'm capable of doing. And they could be minor, just like hurting somebody's feeling or wrecking a relationship, you know, verbally. Yeah, that's fairly minor, right? Or physically violent, you know, with people who are half my size, you know, people who can't defend themselves against me. I fancy myself kind of a fighter, but I really spent most of my time getting my ass kicked, you know. I was convinced that my last words on the planet would be, I was just kidding, man. Face mashed in the hood of the car, you know, just lighten up, man. But that idea that like, I don't know about anybody else, but I'm fairly impressed with my psychic powers, my intellectual ability, my ability to I have an engineering mind. So you give me a problem, I want to mentally break it down into the component parts, analyze them, find out what's useful and discard or keep it and discard what's broken, patch it, fix it, replace it. So now I'm dragging books home from Barnes & Noble, you know, stuff like How to Heal Your Life and, you know, The Inner Child, God, you know, I mean, I'm just bringing these things home in the hope that I'm going to gain some sort of self-knowledge that I can apply to this problem and make this nightmare go away. Now, you guys, I would show up in AA, I'd hurt badly. You got to be pretty mangled to show up at one of these meetings. You know what I mean? It's a distasteful bunch of people. Not you guys. But to come here and to just be part of this thing. And you guys are telling me different things. You guys are telling me your willpower is of no avail, David. You know, your knowledge is of no avail. In fact, David, your intelligence is going to work against you in this process. And I'm thinking, this is absurd, you know? And what you're going to find, if you're an alcoholic, it's going to get worse over any considerable period of time. It's not going to get better, and that's absolutely what I found. The time that I was able to keep the plug in the jug became less and less and less and less, and the things that would happen when I would call it going on the wagon, because that was the only term I had for it, but when I would fall off that wagon for whatever insanely trivial reason. You know, a lost job or a broken shoelace, doesn't really matter. I've just tattered up to here, and I know what to do about that. It just got incredibly impressive to me how quickly it became just as violent, just as disgusting, just as abhorrent as it ever was, no matter how long. I've been good for 6 months. And here I am again, you know. So I never made it that far with a weary, despairing wife. I had pushed everybody away. But he basically is identifying this piece. He's going to identify several pieces in here, my willpower and self-knowledge. And those are two of the tools that I tried to use. I tried to use my own resolve, and I tried to read my way into it, go to the psychiatrist my way into it, tried to learn my way out of alcoholism. And I could not.
Yeah, I, you know, what is this self-knowledge that I have about this, and on this paragraph, behavior, this incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself now. So what am I understanding? I'm seriously ill, and I have a bodily and mental problem. Somehow knowing that didn't make a damn bit of difference. So I did the same thing. I mean, I was sitting in front of psychiatrists at 13. My first suicide attempt was 13. And so long before I was standing over that crib, I was battling. I was internally a battleground. And trying to get that to shut up was my goal. Please, God, make it stop. And when I found alcohol, that made it go quiet. And I thought, this is it. This is the thing that's going to do it. And then I just continued to make that be my priority in life. And everything else was shoved to the side. My education, everything. So this progression that we go through in this loss of a power of choice, you know, another example of that for me is trying to come to grips with this is a mental illness, alcoholism. We don't talk about it very often in the rooms about it being a mental illness, but it really is. My mind will absolutely take me into places that I can't come out of. And that happened to me in sobriety. I hadn't had a drink for some time, and that happened to me. So what it did is it proved to me that I do have this mental illness and this obsession, mental obsession, physical allergy. I've got all of that. So in this progression, seeing this progression happen and then being faced with the same thing that my... in the book, it describes Bill saying to himself, he was devastated. His pride was devastated. And it's interesting to me, he talks about his pride before he talks about his wife. You know, he talks about his pride first. And that was me, you know. I'm like, you mean I can't overcome this? I can't make a decision to make this better? I have such confidence in my ability and my will. You know, because I had all these demonstrations in my life of, you know, as in high school, I was a complete, you know, dope head, alcoholic, didn't go to school, kicked out of school, two schools. And then when I went to college, I just, like, made a decision. I was going to be different, and I was different. I just applied myself. I did well. I'm on the honor roll. I got scholarships. So I was pretty damn impressed with myself. I thought, well, you can do anything. If you did that, you certainly can manage this problem. And when I was pregnant with my daughter, I had, I call it not drinking. A normal person would say, that's not drinking. But for an alcoholic, this is not drinking. I drank, the doctor told me I could have one drink every 8 weeks and it could be a beer, one beer. And I had a calendar and I marked off every day. And when the day came, get out of my way. It was a whole ceremony. I didn't want anybody there. And I just had this relationship with this bottle of beer. And I didn't think there was anything wrong with that. Didn't trip me up or question, you know, this is the deception about it. I'm so self-deceived about it. So even after that, go through the pregnancy and baby's great, now the pressure's off, you know. So now I can go back to what I know. And when I got comfortable taking care of the baby and I got comfortable with the fact that she was okay, you know, she had her brains are in the right place and all her things are in the right place and she's good. And I'm home, my husband is there and we go out to dinner and I drank a half a gallon of wine all by myself. And I want to tell you, you know what that looks like? Mm-hmm. About 2 a.m. It's not pretty. And just absolutely, completely lost it. But I still was convinced. That was just a one-off thing. I haven't had a drink in a long time. I'm just going to have to manage it. I'll be fine. It'll be okay. And I went on my way until I was ended up in that spot I talked about a minute ago. So the progression is deadly. And the longer I succumb to it, the more dishonest I become and the less I am able to tell the truth about what's happening to me. Thanks.
Okay, we're over on page 24 now in the chapter, There Is a Solution. It's going to start with the squiggly writing. The fact is, that's pretty strong, it's a fact. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force of memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. The almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd in the mind to deter us. If these thoughts occur, they are hazy and readily supplanted with the old threadbare idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. There's a complete failure of the kind of defense It keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove. Yeah, so this is, again, part of my broken mind. for whatever reason, he doesn't offer us any explanation. It's yet obscure, David. I'm not going to give you, I can't tell you exactly why. But the fact is, at certain times, I'm unable to defend myself. Well, this is abhorrent to me because I really do believe that I'm in control of the situation. And I believed it then. And I'm thinking of two times in particular. The first time that I, and there were many of these times, but there, you know, I'd go on these little dry spells, and then my mind starts talking to me, and it doesn't say something like, "Why don't you go out and have a drink and destroy everything that you've spent the last few years building up?" That doesn't sound like that. It sounds like, "David, psst, come over here. You're working hard, man. You're showing up on the job every day. You're bringing the money home to mama. Look at you, man. You got promoted. You know, things are going well. You got money in the bank. You're paying your bills. You know, and look at these other chumps. They're not even as smart as you. And look at them. Look at them. They go out to the bar every Friday night and they have a few beers. What's wrong with having a few beers, David? You're over 21 years old. You got to blow the steam off, man. You know, you got to relax." And I pull up a chair to that. You know, I'm like, "Yeah, tell me more." You know, and then I might will my way through that. "No, no, no. You remember what happened last time?" But it's starting to get more hazy and readily supplant, you know. And I remember that when I was 22, I put the plug in the jug. No AA, no help. I stay sober. Damn it. I'm sober. You know, just up on the cross about it. I'm just suffering dramatically. But I'm going along, and some of the human power that I, and some of my self-will, I had decided at that time that I really needed a hobby. A hobby would really be, I'm too bright a guy to be this unoccupied, you know? So I need a hobby. So I start this little aquarium hobby. And within 6 months, I went from a $9.99 starter aquarium to I had created a tropical paradise in a one-bedroom apartment with six aquariums, two of which are over 55 gallons. There's breeder tanks, and you can't go near any of it. Don't breathe on that. You've got germs, you know? I mean, I'm just, ugh. And the poor woman that I'm living with, she can't walk across the room without me having something to say about the way she's, "How come you got to walk across the room like that? You got an attitude? What's up with you?" You know? So I'm just a picnic, you know, to be around. Nothing's right. Nothing's good enough. And stay away from the fish tank and rah, 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 you know, I mean, just this endless procession. And then one day she says, "I think next month," and she's really looking for the right time to spring this on me, and she said, "I'm thinking next month I'll go up and visit my parents by myself for about a week." And I think she thought I was going to object to that. And I was like, and then the thought came in, "You could get drunk as a monkey when she leaves." And that was it. And that week couldn't get by fast enough, man. I mean, it was like the next day, it's like, "You know, really, you're not working that hard. You could get out of here now if you want." So that thought just came in out of nowhere. "I don't want to drink. I mean, I've got an aquarium now." And I mean, she wasn't gone long. And that was it. It started again. I don't even remember where that particular spell ended up, but I know in a very short period of time. Oh, by the time she came back home, I had been hospitalized. I had, in my drunkenness, somebody gave me a recipe for, you could get these materials at the Walgreens and you can cook them up, and it's just like crystal meth. Yeah, I gave myself a really bad headache that wouldn't go away. I had to go to the hospital for that. It was a headache. It lasted about a year and a half, this headache. It was terrible. I mean, so I ended up in a very short time worse than I was before I ever decided to quit drinking in the first place. And then the second time, I remember getting on a plane to go down and visit my father, my two best drinking buddies in the whole world, my brother and my father. And I'm going down to Florida. This is the beginning of my last debauch. And I'd been sober for several months. There was a girl involved. She was encouraging me not to drink. And once again, I've got new hope. There's a new relationship and a new job and a new, and everything's great. And David's not drinking anymore. And I'm going to go visit my father, and I'm not going to drink. In fact, I'm going to show those guys what not drinking looks like. And my brother, unbeknownst to me, books himself on a connecting flight in Charlotte to finish the trip down to Fort Lauderdale. So I'm just basically, all I know is I'm going to Fort Lauderdale, stopping in Charlotte, changing planes in Charlotte. I change the planes, go down the thing, smoke, you know, and then and I get on the plane and I'm just trying to find my seat, and there's my brother. And sitting next to my brother is a double Jack that he had taken the Jack Daniels on the rocks. For those of you who don't know what double Jack is. Who am I talking to? So my brother doesn't know about my plans or my struggles with sobriety or anything. He just did the gentlemanly thing and made sure that David had a drink waiting for him when he got there. And I sat down and I had all those thoughts and all those plans and all those attention. And I just went, yeah, this will be cool. I'll quit tomorrow. I quit 3 months later, four. Anyway, but there was absolutely no defense. There was absolutely no thought of consequence, nothing. There it was, and suddenly it's a good idea. And that threadbare idea, every time I fall off, it sounds like it'll be different this time, or it sounds like I can handle it. I'm just gonna drink beer on Fridays. I can see where crack and tequila are a problem. Those have to go. But Budweiser and a bottle. No more of that keg stuff. You know, I mean, just, I tried them all. So this threadbare idea that I'm going to handle myself differently, I definitely wore the new smell off that fabric. So. Gee. Yeah.
Say it.
Take it from there.
I don't know, when you were talking, I just thought about, my ex-husband and I were in love with alcohol, not each other. And I don't know why this thought came to me, but he dressed drunk in the gutter, literally, one night, got run over by a car. And lived to tell about it, you know. Just had like tire marks across his thigh, right? And this is who I was married to, and this is who I was. I remember one night being sitting in the park. This is long before I was married. Sitting in the park with this girl, my girlfriend, and we're drinking. And we decide, oh God, we're drinking wine and we're just totally just trashed. And we decide we're going to drive down to the club in D.C. And we were wearing platform shoes. You can just figure out when that was. And so I have these platform shoes on. I mean, just like really big platform shoes. And we get in the car. I'm driving. And I said to her, I don't think I can do this. I don't think I can do the gears. She said, well, you steer and I'll do the gears. I'm like, great idea, let's go. So that's what we did. I steered the car. I don't know how I managed the clutch, but I did with the platform shoes. And she did the gears, and we drove to downtown Washington, went to the club, got out of the car, fell flat on my face in the platform shoes. And I said, I'm getting rid of these shoes. These shoes are a real problem. And I actually, not really sure what happened the rest of that night. I don't really remember. But I couldn't, no matter what was happening to me or what had happened to me in the past or last week or yesterday, I always could come up with an explanation for why this made sense. And it made sense to do that because we were out of wine. So it was either go to the package store or go to the club, and the club would be much more fun, so that's what we did. So that was how I made every decision. You know, I didn't ever make a decision. I was forced by my circumstances to do what I did. My circumstances, meaning the alcohol, made every decision for me. And even when I made the decision to not have alcohol in my house, which I would do every so often because I think, no, I've really got to, this is why I'm just not going to have it in the house. So this one night I decided that I'm not going to have it in the house because I've got a deadline. By now, I'm back in the situation, the baby, I'm working. My husband is in the Navy. He's standing duty all night. There's no alcohol in the house, and I'm on a deadline. Well, now I've got the pressure of the world on my shoulders, I'm trying to finish this story I'm trying to write, and I had no money, I had no car, and I had no alcohol in the house. And I had a baby sleeping in the crib in the next room. And I said, I absolutely have to have a drink. I don't care what I have to do to get it, I have to have a drink. So I went searching through the whole house until I could find pennies, nickels, whatever I could find, put it together, walked to the convenience store, which is about 3/4 of a mile from the house, left the baby in the house, and the whole time I'm walking, I'm thinking, oh my God, I've left that baby in the house by herself. Oh my God. It didn't make me turn around. I kept walking until I got to the convenience store and got that beer and came back. Now, I was unnerved while I was doing it, but it didn't stop me. So what would have happened if the house caught on fire? What would have happened? A million things could have happened in that amount of time I was gone. And I didn't care enough. I couldn't care enough. Because I'm just not connected, I don't have any. When it talks about, you don't have the force of memory. If you have a memory, you have will. Will comes from memory. If there's no memory, you have no will. If there's no conscience, you have no God, really. But you have no ability. You are powerless. And that was the state I was in. I had no idea I was in that state. But that is where I was. So this thinking that convinces me that what I'm about to do is okay is really the definition of spiritual illness and mental illness, because there's both things are operable there. I have no conscience. I have no will. I have a physical compulsion to drink. That's a hopeless situation. Thanks.
Okay, we're going to skip down to page 37 near the top. Whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. How can such a lack of proportion of the ability to think straight be called anything else? You may think this is an extreme... Oh, and prior to this, he's told us some stories about Jim putting the whiskey in the milk, and he gives us several illustrations in there. We're substituting our own illustrations. You may think this is an extreme case. To us, it is not far-fetched, for this kind of thinking has been characteristic of every single one of us. We have sometimes reflected more than Jim did upon the consequences, but there was always the curious mental phenomenon that, parallel with our sound reasoning, there inevitably ran some insanely trivial excuse for taking the first drink. Our sound reasoning failed to hold us in check. The insane idea won out. Next day, we would ask ourselves, in all earnestness and sincerity, how could this have happened? And what always glares at me there is this curious mental phenomenon that, parallel with our sound reasoning. And I think in pictures, but I imagine railroad tracks. And all my life, I don't see myself as a marauding, maniacal, destructive Tasmanian devil force moving through the planet, devouring everything in my path. I really see myself as a kind man, as an intelligent person. I understand the value of and the meaning of things like reciprocity and decency and basic human kindness and keeping your promises. Something so simple. I see myself as a man of integrity. I do what I say I'm going to do. I keep my promises. All those are right intact the whole way. A parallel. There's one of those rails absolutely knows the right thing to do and how to do it and why it's good to do and all that stuff and what's right and wrong. I know that stuff. I've always known that stuff. But then there's this other track. You know, this insanely trivial, yeah, well, a girlfriend's going out of town. Might as well. You know, I deserve it. I need a break. I need a little me time. And how am I going to get that? Me and my, you know, what I've been really, really wanting to do this whole time is to get fallen down drunk. So, again, the insanity is not like Nuthouse straitjacket. It can be, certainly. But it's just this ability to think straight. Because the truth is, once I start, I don't know when I'm going to stop. I don't know where I'm going to end up. And more often than not, stuff's going to break. You know, bones and promises and all that stuff. It's never good. And I always end up embarrassed and appalled and disgusted to the point where I can't even look myself in the mirror, the things that I'm capable of saying and doing. That always happens. Well, if you're sane, you would look at that and say, oh, well, let's not do that anymore. Problem solved, right? But I keep going back. I keep going back and I keep going back. We're going to try to get to some hope here. Soon. Judy?
Yeah, the insane idea. I just don't know it's an insane idea. I don't have any appreciation for that. When David was talking about the book that I read that in my quest for understanding what was wrong with me, certainly it can't be. I just didn't want the answer to be that I couldn't drink. I kept looking for another answer. There has to be another answer. There must be medication. There must be a diagnosis. There has to be something because I really don't want to stop drinking. And that's an insane idea. Why would you look at the fabric of your life and everything that you've been through and be able to say to yourself, I don't want to stop drinking? I mean, that baffled me. So this book that I read was called The Courage to Change. And I picked it, I don't know where I got it, I picked it off a library shelf or something. And it did make me go to my first meeting. But sitting in that meeting, I started to think, this can't possibly be the answer. So again,
is there someone else I could talk to?
I know. Is there? It has to be. Really? This is what we're gonna do now. And I felt like that was everything. I don't know. Being an alcoholic is like being in a house of mirrors. Everywhere I go, I run into myself, and everything I think is upside down. You know. I thought it was an insane idea to be here, and it made more sense to try to manage this on my own. That's crazy business, you know? You can't do that. Same thing with my decision to marry the man that I married. Why would I marry him? If anybody with logical brain looked at the situation, they would have not done it, you know? There's nothing in my life I've done that makes sense. Every decision I've made ends up in this horrible mess. The big thing with me is I felt like an open wound all the time, you know? I was, I didn't like people, but I didn't want to be alone. You know, it was always these two things going on. And when I was with you, I wanted to be away from you. And when I was away from you, I wanted to be with you. And it was just all this stuff going on and on and on, you know, all these plates spinning in my head all the time. And the only thing I could do to make that not matter was drink. As soon as I had a drink, it just didn't matter anymore, you know. You could be there or not be there. And I was always trying to find that place, you know, where I can get to that place where it doesn't matter anymore. And the problem is that as I lived as an active drinker, the things that happened to me, like standing over that baby's crib, just started creeping in to my consciousness in a way that I couldn't shut it off. Now my solution doesn't work anymore. Now I'm really in a bad place. So, you know, the next insane idea that gets to win out is suicide. And what I didn't know, before I stopped drinking was, drinking was suicide. I was just trying to kill myself slow. I was listening to the speaker recently, and he's talking about, you know, you go to the doctor, and the doctor says, you know, if you don't stop this, you're going to die. And he says, do you promise by Wednesday? And that's how I felt. I was like, this is going really too slow. And now it's too painful. Now it's too painful to drink it. So now I have to have another answer. And for me, the other answer was I was going to take my life. So if I didn't stop drinking and didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have taken my life, absolutely. So there's the insane idea, when and out. So it's just proof to me that in active alcoholism, the insane idea will win out. And without the alcohol, when the alcohol becomes too painful and the thinking is still in control, the insane idea is going to win out. And that's the next stop. You know, if you don't stay here and grab on, most of us end up there. Thanks.
So on page 41, he's told us another story of a guy who intended not to drink and then made a decision to take a drink and then got to the other side of that. At the bottom of the page, as soon as I regained my ability to think, I went over carefully that evening in Washington. Not only had I been off guard, I had made no fight whatever against the first drink. This time, I had not thought of the consequences at all. I commenced to drink as carelessly as though the cocktails were ginger ale. I now remembered what my alcoholic friends had told me, how they prophesized that if I had an alcoholic mind, the time and place would come, I would drink again. They said that though I did raise a defense, it would one day give way before some trivial reason for having a drink. Well, just that did happen and more. For what I had learned of alcoholism did not occur to me at all. I knew at that moment that I had an alcoholic mind. I saw that willpower and self-knowledge would not help me in those strange mental blank spots. I had never been able to understand people who said that a problem had them hopelessly defeated. I knew then it was a crushing blow. And, you know, what that looked like for me, I had made yet one more run. I surrendered to the disease of alcoholism on that plane on the way home from Florida. I remember vowing that I would stay drunk for the rest of my life. That I didn't care how long that was. I did not care if it was 50 days or 50 years, but I was no longer going to try to stay sober anymore because it's too hard. And 3 months later, my attention was grabbed by blue lights in the rearview mirror in Fairfax County, a place I had not planned on going when I woke up that morning. And that was my one and only brush with the law in my adult life. I don't have I spent 6 hours in a drunk tank and I was in a blackout. I had a pretty good time. They let you smoke, you know, it was fine. And I had another run. I was drunk by noon after I got out of jail that morning as well. But then I had another run at AA, and I ran with you guys for about 90 days. Felt a little better. I was 28 years old. I healed up pretty quick. And you said something I didn't like one day, and I was like, well, that's enough AA. And so then I spent another 6 months, no AA, no drink. So I once again, I'm an alcoholic without a drink and without a solution. And that was where my flow chart led me to as well. Because at that point, I absolutely desperately did not want to drink again. I really did not want to have another drink. I knew where it was going to take me. I was convinced what that was going to look like. I tried everything that I could bring to bear on the situation, and I just didn't want that anymore. And just as badly as I didn't want it, I knew that I was going to get drunk. Mm-hmm. I know exactly what that feels like. And so I lived with that for months. Just knowing I was going to get drunk, and not today, not today. They said just for today, you know. And I don't want to, and I know I'm going to. I don't want to, I know I'm going to. And so then I just would spend my day driving around Norfolk looking for tall buildings to jump off of. Because why? I can't live like this. I can't live like this. So that was I didn't have these words, believe me, at that time. But I had some idea that I had an alcoholic mind. This was what was wrong with me. And it was that, I believe that was me taking the first step at that point. And I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous one more time. And no different than any other time I'd come through the doors. But I heard things differently. And I remember sitting in that meeting going, you know what, I don't even know what they're talking about, but I'm going with these people. I'm going to do what they do. And that was enough.
Yeah, and I'll just close with this. Everything inside of me, being at that exact spot David's talking about, everything inside of me sitting in an AA meeting wanted me to just jump up and run out of the room. And but the pain of drinking was so hard, was so tough now, and the pain of being sober was so hard. I was at that juggernaut they talk about in another part of the book. And I just knew, I don't know how I knew, to just stay still. I don't care. I just had all this crap going on in my head every time anybody talked, but I just kept sitting in the seat. And they kept telling me, just keep coming back, just keep sitting in the seat. The more you sit in the seat, the better off you're going to be. Just sit in the seat. This isn't going to last forever. You're never going to be here again. If you walk this path and stay the course, you will never be here again. And I've never been there again. I have never been in that kind of torture, mental, physical, emotional, or spiritual, ever. So, okay. I'm ready to wrap it up.
Wrap it up.
Okay. We're going to pass the seventh tradition basket. And the seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It's both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district, area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. The amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world. Okay, and announcements. We are going to announce that on January 14th, we are going to be next door for a supper and a speaker. We have from Ocean City.
Rich B.
And we are going to have some great food that we're all going to bring at 6 o'clock. And then at 7 o'clock, the speaker will commence. We invite everybody to join us. Are there any other announcements tonight?
There are flyers on the table for supper and a speaker, again, on the 14th. That's a Monday. And there's also flyers for something going on at the depot as well. But feel free to take some with you. Take them back to your home groups. They're right there.
Okay. Yes, sir.
I'm Graham. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Graham.
I don't really know where to ask, but this is New Year's Eve, right?
Correct.
I don't know about other people, but for me, the first few years sober, this was a very trying night not to drink. So there are things going on, right, where people can go tonight. Where are they?
Easy Does It Club is open.
Right, the Easy Does It Club's open in Norfolk, and then there's a thing on at the ocean front in Virginia Beach.
Mm-hmm.
But that's $25, right?
Yeah.
I think the Easy Does It Club's not $25. I don't know how much it is, but probably could just go there.
In the young.
there's one over on the peninsula as well.
Yeah.
And it's just the idea there's a bunch of people in AA there having fun, not drinking, and it's somewhere safe to go if that's an issue for you tonight.
There's also another meeting across the street at 8 o'clock.
There you go.
2 hours at 8 for sleep.
There you go.
It's at 5:30 at the Raleigh Avenue.
Just go around the back.
It's a Methodist church.
Oh, 2:13.
It's the 2:13.
Okay.
Okay. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Home group members, raise your hands. We have literature available. Please see me or any of the home group members after the meeting. And do we have anybody who's new you'd like to introduce yourself to us so we can get to know you a little bit? Anybody new to Alcoholics Anonymous?
Matt.
Welcome.
I'm Heather from Alcoholic. I'm in and out. Try again. That's my
favorite. Welcome. Come
on. You can stay this time.
You can stay.
I am going to stay this time.
Okay. Welcome.
Sponsorship is in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. Would anyone willing to be a sponsor please raise your hand? Okay, and I just want to thank everybody for participating tonight. After we clean up, everybody's invited and encouraged to continue the conversation on the stuff we discussed tonight. All are welcome to attend the meeting after the meeting, if we are having one, are we?
I think we're not going to Bella Pizza tonight, but that's what we usually, after this meeting, we all adjourn to Bella Pizza for fellowship.
And I think there may be one or two home group members that are going to do that tonight, and so I might wander over there. Are those one or two going to do that?
If you're willing to do something after the meeting, just say something.
Go.
Somebody will do something with you.
Yeah. Grab each other. And, yeah, let's do that. Okay, and Mike has volunteered to read the last two paragraphs on 164.
Mike Alcoholic.
Hey, Mike.
Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Amen.
Amen. Please join us and close the meeting with the Lord's Prayer. You want to lead us out.
Our Father.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Happy New Year!
Yeah.